Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
Well, that's right. This is Ida History. I'm your host, Jeff Wade, sitting in the same room as my co-host, Mark, for the first time in a few weeks, right? Mark, what's going on there?
That's right, man. Get together and get the mojo going.
Yeah. This is probably a better idea for this episode because it's more kind of relaxed and conversational than what we're going for usually.
Right. We've been using the old internet machine.
Yeah.
Trying to get our podcast recordings done at some great distance between Nampa and Eagle. But we thought this one, a firsthand face-to-face conversation, was necessary.
And I'm all jacked up on Mountain Dew. So, Mark, what are we talking about tonight?
Well, Jeff is up, you know, drinking the mountain piss, and we're going to talk about Jefferson Standifer, an all-around interesting character, a man of the West, a man of the South, a man of clandestine intrigue, like James Bond if he was in the Civil War period, minor Idahoan. Idaho Territorian? I don't know.
For a brief time, yeah. Very brief time.
Yeah. So, we're going to talk about him. And he has been Jeff, our Jeff's, Jeff Wade, his area of focus for what, 5 years, something like that?
Has it been that long already? I mean, it took me about a year to write the first draft of my book. So that was, 3-4 years ago. So, yeah, it's been about 5 years. I've been, he's been part of my life in a strange way.
Right. So we've read, well, of course, Jeff has read his book, but I read Jeff's second edition of his book, Brave as a Lion, Jeff Standifer and the Knights of the Golden Circle. And that might sound somewhat fantastical, kind of like a Harry Potter novel or something, but it was a real deal. So I just want to read up the summary of the back of your book, but it was basically this. He was called the Kit Carson of the Northwest, the Daniel Boone of the mines, and the Builder of Idaho. Jeff Standifer was a lot of things, pioneer, prospector, and lawman. He explored much of the Intermountain West, but history has largely forgotten his name, perhaps by design, as he was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. This secretive group aimed to take the mineral wealth of the West for the Confederate cause during the U.S. Civil War. This is the story of Standifer's life and the organization to which he pledged his loyalty.
You know, Mark, you mentioned that this kind of sounds like a Harry Potter book, and there has been so many times I've told people about this and the kind of the basic outline of Jeff's life, and they stop me and they're like, is this a novel? I'm like, nope, this is the real deal. This all actually happened according to the sources that I've found.
So. Right. It very much sounds like, you know, like, they get to Hogwarts and they're like, where are the Knights of the Golden Circle? Avaka Kedargium or whatever they say.
Well, the real.
You should cut that.
No. The real Knights of the Golden Circle were pretty derpy, so it fits pretty good.
Yeah. Well, they were dangerous derpy, though.
They were. Yeah, that's true.
So. But I thought we might just get right into this conversation.
So, yeah. You're just going to kind of interview me, ask me some questions, and.
Well, first, before we get in there, anything you want to say to the folks, the people, our listeners, our fans?
We love you. Thanks for listening. Keep listening. Tell your friends. Tell your mom. Tell your dog.
Tell your mom. All right.
Moms love history. It's, yeah.
A lot of our followers on Instagram and the people that like kind of spur their husbands to go on our tours are moms.
Yeah. And your mom, she's a great lady. She's very supportive. We love her.
Yeah, I know.
Hi, Donna.
Hi, Mom. She is. She's very supportive. And she gets my old man to figure out how to listen.
Yeah.
And that is no small feat to try and get him to understand what's going on with podcasts. But
that's
yeah,
all
we
I
just,
got.
We just have some stuff coming up as far as, what is that? Lectures by Lushes on October 20th.
Mad Swede.
Yeah, we're going to get buzzed. I'm not going to get drunk, but I'm going to get buzzed. And we're going to give a slide presentation and hopefully a funny one at that.
I hope so.
Right.
That's a funny subject.
It definitely is.
Yeah. Parts of it, anyway.
Yeah.
Pretty tragic at the same time, but yeah.
Mommy's Mummy. We'll just leave it there. But okay. Anyway, so let's jump right into Jeff Stanfer here. Jefferson Stanfer is his biblical name. You know, he's interesting because he's a son of the South, right? Born in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And he's born in, what, the 1830s?
1834 is my best estimate.
But then he becomes a member of or a sort of a Southwesterner, but not like New Mexico or Arizona. We're talking Texas.
Texas frontier, baby.
Right? So it's still South, but it's the westmost of the South, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he, in this way, he's a son of the South, but he also experiences coming up in the West in Indian territory, as they would call it. Well, not the Oklahoma Indian territory, right. But, you know, like this is contested space that they're in.
Comanche lands.
Right. And the Comanches were freaky, man. They were like crazy warrior, yeah. Good, skilled hunters, outdoorsmen, all that.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about his father, his mother, his early life, his brothers on the Texas frontier.
So his father moved the family to a place called Bastrop, Texas, which at the time was the most frontier that you could get at the time. This is way out there. So him and a couple other families kind of moved and created this, almost call it like a colony. But yeah, they were in the middle of Comanche lands. Jefferson Stanfer, and then he's got a couple of brothers and I think two sisters. It's kind of funny because some of the brothers, so Jefferson was named after Thomas Jefferson, the president, and then two of his other brothers were also named after presidents as well. So, you know, kind of patriotic tinge to this family, as many, you know, Southerners were at the time. So they go out to the frontier. There's an incident where there's a cow that was slaughtered in this colony. So Jeff's dad, James Stanfer, kind of gets together with some of the other men in the area, and they go out and they fight this battle, basically, with a group of natives and basically kill them all, I think, is what the story is.
Yeah, it's kind of a harsh story.
It really is, yeah. There's a father and a son that they kill at the end.
And he got shot like three times trying to protect his son.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that's sadly the story of the West in a lot of times.
Yeah, there's this great book by Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian.
Oh yeah.
And he paints the West as apocalyptic, which really,
yeah,
it was. And the way I kind of was thinking about this scene in your book is either I'm going to kill all of yours or you're going to kill all of mine. And that is frequently what happened.
Yeah.
So you don't leave anything to chance and you just kill everybody. It was a war of attrition in many ways.
Right. Yeah. So Jeff's dad and mother die when Jeff was pretty young. I think he was 15, 16. So basically leaves him as an orphan. But then his brothers kind of take charge of his upbringing and, 1849 rolls around. Mark, what happened in 1849?
Sutter's Mill.
Sutter's Mill. The big gold rush in California starts.
Well, they found it in 48, right?
Yeah, then the rush started the next year, which is often how it works with these gold rushes. They try to keep it a secret for a while, then the secret gets out.
Yeah, you hear that, Niners fans? You ought to be the 48ers.
Yes.
Just kidding. We love our Niners, right?
Yep. No. So a couple of the brothers go out to California, and then Jeff and one of his older brothers follow the next year in 1850. Mine some gold, I think. And then, yeah.
So the parents die, and then he's kind of raised by his brothers, though he's a young man. So he's not quite he's not like a little kid.
Yeah.
And so eventually he and one of his brothers, right, they go westward towards, at first, California, and then on from there, he goes quite a few places. Tell us about that, Jeff.
So, yeah, I have him going to Hawaii for a short time, and then from Hawaii, he supposedly kills a man. I can't find a lot of records on that to verify that story. Then he ends up basically saved by his oldest brother, what's his name?
Buford?
Is it Buford?
Buford T. Stanford? BP.
BP. Yeah, his oldest brother, BP, stand for, as I refer to him in the book. BP helps him out, basically gets him out of this pickle. They go back to California, do some mining there. From California, it's up to British Columbia for the Fraser River Gold Rush. Right. BP and Jeff spend some time up there. They get some gold out of the ground there. And then it's down to Nevada, Virginia City, where, again, they're mining. There's one account that says Jeff killed a Mexican in a saloon. And then from there, it's to Walla Walla, Washington, and then to the Idaho mines. So,
yeah. And that, of course, is important to our conversation because we're Idahoans.
Yes, we are.
Right.
That's where the whole builder of Idaho thing comes in from the back of the book.
Okay. So when he arrives in Idaho, that time period, the Idaho territory, what's the political situation like in the South? What is it like when he grows up there, and what does it become when he goes in 18?
So obviously we're talking antebellum period. Basically, there's a lot of tension between abolitionists and slave owners. There's violence that occurs, you know, talking about John Brown and the trying to incur the start a slave revolt. He's hung. And then you have in the couple decades before the Civil War, you had these groups called Southern Rights Clubs. And basically, they're these basically, and I say basically too much, Mark, so I need to stop that.
I have my own thing, which, like, you know, like, and so, or I digress. That's that's my thing. So
anyway, there's these politicians and businessmen who are basically, they're trying to advance the cause of slavery, because by this time, the international slave trade had been outlawed for, you know, almost 60 years at the beginning of the Civil War. So it was really hard to get slaves. And there's a lot of back and forth in the legislature trying to either keep slavery or get rid of it. And so these Southern Rights Clubs pop up to help try to help keep slavery as an institution in the United States and maybe expand it into other portions of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, we're not done being assholes. We want to spread our assholedom across the world.
Yeah, really.
That's my biased interpretation of trying to spread slavery to other countries. But anyway, basically, just kidding, Jeff. So what you're getting to is this thing, and as we understand filibustering to be, is Mr. Smith goes to Washington and he stands up at the podium and, you know, tries not to pee his pants because he has to speak for as long as possible to
delay the vote. Yeah. Right?
But that's not the filibustering we're talking about.
So the filibustering we're talking about is you take a group of men, of mercenaries, a private army, as you will, and you send them down to a poorly defended, poor country, right? And you use your army to basically install yourself as the leader of that nation. So there's this group called the Knights of the Golden Circle that form in the South, and they are kind of a coalescing of all these Southern Rights Clubs. And what they do is they have this big old plan. And there's several attempts to do this filibustering thing. There was an incident in Mexico where a California state senator gets 1,000 men and they go down in Mexico. They're all captured and beheaded. There's probably the most famous example is William Walker, who actually became the president of Nicaragua for a short period of time.
Wow.
And then he was deposed, came back to the U.S., faced some criminal charges on the Monroe Doctrine.
Right.
And then he goes back down there and tries again, and he's captured and executed by the Nicaraguans. So you have that. So you have the Knights of the Golden Circle. They come on board. They come with a plan to do this. So starting in Cuba, and then if you draw a 1,200-mile circle around Havana, you get all the way up into Maryland. You get west into like Kansas. You get to the tippy top of South America, and then all of the Caribbean. They wanted to control this as the Golden Circle. That's where their name comes from, the Knights of the Golden Circle. They would, if that were to come to pass, they would have controlled all the coffee rice, tobacco, all those exports from that area. So they would have been
cotton.
Yeah. And this would have been a slavery empire.
Yeah. And that, wow. So from the land of the free, the home of the brave, possibly could have started this largest slave holding nation on earth.
Yeah.
That, wow. I don't see any contradictions, but okay. So that's the grandest of their grand plans, right? Right. But in the working, you know, on the ground, you know, politics and, you know, combat and clandestine affairs, what are they claiming that they did? What are their first thoughts right at 1860-61? What is it that they're trying to get done?
So they claimed responsibility for starting the Civil War. And how they say they did that is they, real quick trip on the 1860 election, you had Lincoln and he was running against two Democrats because the Democrat Party split their ticket. So Lincoln was able to win because ticket was split. You had the Southerners voting for David Breckinridge, and then you had the Northern Democrats voting for, who was it, Douglas that he ran against?
I don't remember.
Anyway, so Lincoln wins the election because of this. So the Knights of the Golden Circle said, we were responsible for splitting the Democrat ticket. Whether that's true or not, it's hard to say.
Yeah. But
there are a lot of other factors involved.
But they got their boy in, and by their boy, the person they hated the most.
Yeah.
Abraham Lincoln.
Yep.
Abraham Lincoln be stinking to these guys, I tell you what. So they wanted him in there so he would cause the Civil War. He would cause the split.
Because they wanted the issue of slavery decided, and they knew that the only way it would be decided was through war.
You know, but if that's the case, to the Knights of the Golden Circle, that whole idea of the war of northern aggression, that's all hogwash.
Right. If they started it.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's hogwash regardless, but
yeah,
there was some aggression for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway.
Can't have a war without aggression, right?
Right, exactly. Okay, so in the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. right, what do these plans look like? What does the Civil War and secessionism look like in the Pacific Northwest?
So when the war started, members of the KGC, the Knights of the Golden Circle, they go underground, basically. And they come out west. They go to California disguised as miners and merchants and that kind of thing. And so they get to California and they really ingrain themselves within the political machinery of California. So they get government jobs. They get voted into public office. And there was a time where there was a large population of California and Oregon that wanted to split off from the United States and create the Pacific Republic.
Right.
This was a very real movement that happened, kind of like Greater Idaho is more or less very real.
Right.
Right. Well, I think that's more of a political stunt myself. But so not only that, you had members of the Knights of the Golden Circle all the way up to British Columbia. And there's actually an incident we'll probably talk about a little later on where a Confederate spy goes from the South through Texas, through Mexico, California, all the way up to British Columbia to deliver some papers to the British that were occupying British Columbia to buy a what they called a commerce raider, which is a ship that would be used to disrupt the shipping of the right. Union on the West Coast. We'll talk about him a little bit more with because Standifer plays into that story quite a bit. So, yeah, the Southerners and the Knights of the Golden Circle, they were out here in the West. They were trying to do what they could to disrupt the Union presence out right. in the West. Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of this had to do with Britain. You know what I mean? Would they join or would they yeah. give credence to the Confederacy? They obviously wanted cotton.
Yeah.
And so though they outlawed slavery on the high seas, this was by no means a settled issue in Britain, right?
And there was a lot of underground trading from the South to Britain at right. the time. Yeah, there's some shady stuff going on.
Well, because when they outlawed on the high seas, then that becomes like really pushing the notion of chattel slavery or by birth You know, yeah. It's my right to own you if your parents were my property, quote unquote.
Right. And then you had the British up there in America's hat, and then in America's pants, or Mexico as we call it, you had the French. And right. So the West, like, there was a very real threat to the West at this time. If anything different had happened with the Civil War, I mean, we could be speaking British or French right now.
So the British are up near our head, and the French are below us. Yeah. Are they a little worried about Sacré-Poo? Huh?
We'll talk more about that here in a minute.
All right. Well, okay. All French poo jokes aside. So the formation of the 1st Oregon Cavalry is sort of in reply to the fear of these secessionist groups and machinations.
We talked about them quite a bit in our Snake War episode.
Right.
And I think I read the letter from Abraham Lincoln to them. So these men joined up to go fight the war, but they were ordered to stay and guard the roads back home, back in the West. So they spent a lot of time in Oregon and Idaho. The Washington Volunteers came down to Idaho. And so they were frustrated that they didn't get to go fight the war.
Right.
Obviously, you know, patrolling roads and such is pretty boring. But they were protecting against Native attacks. They fought the Natives quite a bit. But when they got together, they wrote a letter to President Lincoln, basically begging him to allow them to go east to fight the war. Lincoln's reply was, he said that you need to stay home. You need to stay there to protect against those Native attacks and secessionist conspiracies or secessionist plots. So right. It's a very, very poignant what they were there for.
And that's the most interesting thing about this read. I knew that there was, you know, there was Civil War, there were battles in New Mexico and, you know, skirmishes, all the way into, what, California or Arizona for sure, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was a Confederate unit that got all the way. They said they were within sight of California. I don't know if that's, you know, hyperbole or what, but there was a battle in Colorado.
But if you talk about these, like, clandestine groups and these militia groups that join up and form, like, there are the combat might not be in the physical sense, but there are it's a chessboard throughout America, yeah, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And so that's what this brings to mind here and what makes it so interesting to me. But so in Idaho, gold's discovered, right? First up Pierce, Florence area, right? And then in the Boise Basin, August 2nd, 1862, George Grimes finds gold and shot like the next day by some Shoshone that don't want him around.
Yeah.
So Jeff Stanifer is part of this group that kind of comes in right after that first wave returns, right?
So, yeah. So Jeff, we last left him back up at Walla Walla, right?
Right.
So when gold is found in Idaho, he comes in Idaho. He mines at Florence, and then he comes down to the Boise Basin. He's also, before he comes into Idaho, he's actually named as the first sheriff of Idaho County, which is a huge, ginormous chunk of land at this time. Because I think at the time, obviously, this was Eastern Washington Territory at the time. They established three counties first. It was Nez Perce, Shoshone, and Idaho County. Jeff was the sheriff of Idaho County. Not only that, but his brother was the first mayor, appointed mayor, not elected, appointed mayor of Walla Walla, Washington.
Oh, okay.
So these men, these two Stanifer brothers, they obviously have some kind of political clout, something that's, you know, getting them these appointments. As much as I like to believe that we're given stuff like this on our own merits, they were definitely connected somehow.
Right.
And I believe they were connected through the Knights of the Golden Circle, because there is some evidence that Jeff, at least, was involved with this group or a member of this group.
Was Walla Walla, do you know if it was a pro-Confederate, pro-Union? Because
all these mining camps and supply points were about 50-50 split. Like,
right.
You see that all through the early mining camps in Idaho and even down into the Boise Basin.
Right, but Boise was majority Confederate, though, for a while, right?
Well, we talked about that 1864 election where there was a group of Missourians.
Missourians,
yeah. And they came and they kind of influenced the election. But it seemed like it was a very fluid thing because you had these populations that were moving through different areas at the time. So,
yeah, there's a great book about Wild Bill Hickok. And he was fighting out there in the Missouri area and in Kansas, Arkansas. And he actually fought General Price's army.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he was a scout and whatnot, yeah. Packer. But anyway, it's all very interesting. But so he's a sheriff of Idaho County, and he's prospecting in Florence. And he's part of this Salmon River expedition, right? So
yeah, the Salmon River expedition. So Jeff's associated with lost mine stories. Mark, do you have any favorite lost mine stories?
So many that I've lost my mind.
Excellent.
Mine. There was a good joke in there somewhere, I swear.
You were close. Mm-hmm. So lost mine, basically someone goes out into the boonies, they find a big chunk of minerals or ore, whatever, bring it back. It's a save. They go back to find to go mine it. They can't find it again. It's kind of this... it's kind of a trope in Western literature.
Right.
So Jeff, he's involved in one down in California before he comes up to Idaho called the Lost Peg Leg Mine. And Peg Leg is, I think I'll save that story for our episode that we do on him because he spent some time in early Idaho as well. So we're going to cover him. He's an interesting fella. And then, yeah, so the Salmon River Expedition. So Beaver Dick, one of our favorite named Idahoans, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a Beaver Dick Park over in Rexburg.
Well, you know, I just want to know if guys like us, who probably, at least I'm 43, I probably shouldn't be laughing like this now, but I wonder if guys like that back when he lived in the 1860s, were they like... Beaver Dick, man, there he comes. Right, Beaver Dick's ferry, you know.
I mean, supposedly he got that name from old Brigham Young, so maybe.
Oh well, if Brigham gives you a name, well, you better. Anyway,
so sorry. Beaver Dick, also his real name was Richard Lay. The story goes is that he was out on the Salmon River, finds this fantastic ledge of silver. And so he goes back to Florence and he tells everybody about it. So Jeff and this group of men, they go out and they try to find this ledge. It's kind of disastrous because their boats hit the current. Their supply boat is sunk and lost. And then I think the other boats ended up getting lost as well. They had to end up walking back to Florence, starving to death, you know. So it's kind of disastrous. They didn't blame old Beaver Dick, though, because they believe that the assay on the ore that he found was they had lied to him about it just to mess with him or something. But then he's involved. Jeff's involved in the Lost Lemon mine up in Canada, northern Montana, Canada area later on in his life too. So it's kind of interesting, these lost mine stories. There's a couple in Idaho that we could talk about.
If I've learned anything over my years in college and elsewhere, it's never blame the beaver, always blame the dick.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Is that a health class topic?
I think it was phys ed. Okay. I don't know. all right. So now we're talking about the Boise Basin, right?
Yes.
And he leads what essentially is the third party into the Boise Basin after the murder of George Grimes, right?
So George Grimes and Moses Blond got together, kind of combined their parties, right?
Yeah.
And then there was another party. I think it was guided by Ralph Bledsoe. There was a second party to come in, and then Stanifer and his boys roll into town.
And they called Pioneerville Hog'em because it's really cool. Pioneerville today, it's still up there. There's some cabins and stuff, and we have some pictures of it on Instagram that I've taken. But basically, they set up a wooden palisade kind of situation and built some dugouts and houses, like cabins. And so when the other miners get in there, like Jefferson included, they're hogging all the gold, Fort Hog'em.
All the claims that they'd laid out were taken.
Right. And there's some weird, there's some places up there on maps that, old maps, of course, and it's like Boston or Granite Creek or, you know, Hog'em. And you're like, oh, okay, well, Hog'em's Pioneerville. But anyway, it's like, so that's that's 1862, right? Into 1863.
Yeah.
Before Idaho City is even a thing. It's West Bannock.
So Jeff camps, he sets up his camp where Idaho City is now.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think you could probably argue that Idaho City, West Bannock at the time, sprang up from his original camp.
Oh, okay. Cool. Was Trudy's Pie there?
Yeah. They had their first pie was baked, I think, in 1863, early 1863.
Oh, man. Yeah. I love those pies. Trudy's. Anyway. Okay. So it's not all peaceful up there, though. We got the Shoshone and the Bannock, right? Mm-hmm. And they're none too happy that this place is being settled because they're aware that nothing good happens to native communities when white guys find gold, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a sort of some warfare going on.
Yeah. I mean, they'ez already watched their northern neighbors, the Nez Perce, deal with the white incursion onto their lands.
Right.
Obviously, this is before the Bannocks and the whites or the what they call the snake, quote, snake Indians, made any attempt at peace with each other or any treaties right. or anything. But what happens is you have these mining camps set up in the Boise Basin. They needed supplies, but the supply trains started to be attacked by natives. Maybe Chief Bigfoot was around for this. Maybe. Not sure.
Was Beaver Dick there too?
Beaver Dick was around, yes.
Okay.
We'll talk about him here in a second. Okay. So because of this, and because of the murder of George Grimes, Stanifer puts together a group of men, and he calls them Stanifer's Rangers. They drill, practice on the town square at Placerville.
Oh, yeah.
And where the flagpole is, you know.
Yeah, you got that great lithograph in your book.
Yeah. Speaking of Placerville, the Magnolia Saloon, which is, I think, probably the oldest building standing in that area now.
Right.
Jeff cool. Stanifer helped build that saloon.
Very cool little square, even if it's, not what it used to be.
Right, but
it's still cool.
So from there, the whole idea was these are miners. These are merchants that are basically giving up their mines and their claims, their stores, to go fight the Indians, fight the natives. And they don't have any hope at compensation because they're all volunteers. There were situations in Oregon where men were compensated for stuff like this, but it was a lot of paperwork, a lot of basically begging from the government to give them the money. So they didn't have any of that. But they did. What they did is they filed a muster roll with the Washington territorial government. And so there's this big list of names in there, and I can't remember how many of them there were. Probably 30. You've seen the list, right? There's probably 30, 40 right. names on there. A couple of people that were involved with this that are interesting characters. David Updike, who right. became the first sheriff of Ada County and was hung by vigilantes.
Right.
There was Matt Bledsoe, who was I'm actually writing some stuff for my next book right now about him. He was a notorious outlaw in the Pacific Northwest at the time.
As was his brother, Drew.
Well, Drew threw bombs. Drew only threw bombs, so.
He was a patriot, a true patriot. Okay. All right, go ahead.
So what happens is they go from the Boise Basin, they follow Morris Creek down probably through what's now Lucky Peak.
I think
So they follow that down and they come east toward Mount Home, and there's a place called Mayfield.
Right.
Mayfield was later a town. Now it's a ghost town.
We've been there.
We have been. There's some cool buildings there.
Yeah, you can't get the cool Boot Hill Cemetery, though, because
it's private property.
Yeah, we were out there looking for those arrows for the first mail planes.
Right, yeah.
But anyway.
So they camp, and then their scouts come. They say there's some signs of Indian activity. There's a chase. It's pretty exciting. I detail all this in my book, but they end up besieging a native camp. And what happens is Jeff goes into the camp to try to negotiate. And what he's asking for is that they give up the murderer of George Grimes.
Right.
Which, again, that kind of seems like a justification to me for what's about to happen. Because right. they probably didn't know who killed him. There's several bands of Shoshone and Bannock living in this area. So who,
Right.
And they're not going to pull out their fingerprint kit and, dust for prints and try to figure out who actually killed them.
And who's interpreting,
Right, yeah.
I mean, but anyway, yeah.
Who's actually, I know that. Mountain Jack. Mountain Jack was a white who had been taken captive by natives early on in his life and then later on released.
That's right. You say that.
Yeah. Talk about Mountain Jack. Some people think that that was Reuben Van Ornum from the Van Ornum Massacre.
Right.
I don't think the timelines quite line up on that, but it's hard to say because details just aren't there. Anyway, the Shoshone or Bannock, whoever he's dealing with, I can't remember at the time, or if it even says in the source material, they say, you know, bugger off. And so Jeff leaves. So what he does is he takes, there's these rifle pits all around the camp that the natives are basically holding sentry in. Jeff sends, at night, he sends men to crawl up there on their hands and knees and take aim at each one of these rifle pits. As soon as dawn, the sun comes up, there's a shot heard. One of the sentries dies instantly, and then all the rest of the sentries are dispatched. At that point, the rest of the rangers start firing out of the camp. They say the word they use is weird. They say stampeded. The camp is stampeded, so they're all chased out of there. Right. I don't know how many people died in this. The numbers aren't clear, but I'm sure quite a few natives died. And not only this, but there's more to this story, right?
Yeah, I heard that. Well, I mean, I have heard prior to knowing you, and also while knowing you, that it was like an unrelenting massacre of women, children, men, old women, whatever. But then I've also heard that it was not quite that level of, although women and children were killed. But.
So there are several sources on these stories. And about half and half are very complimentary of what they did. And they say that they avoided killing any women and children.
Right.
The other half said it was a complete slaughter. So,
and so what are the sources that say it was a complete slaughter?
Remember off the top of my head.
Are they like Native American sources?
Well, that's the thing. I cannot find any
memory, oral tradition.
Yeah. I cannot find anything from the Native perspective on this. And that's kind of sad. I actually reached out to the tribes and I asked, but they didn't.
Did they reply?
They replied a couple times, and then they stopped replying to me after I kept asking questions. So,
well, okay. And then who are the people that saying he was good and or not he, but you know, they were fair.
Yeah, there's, I think Haley did. McConnell definitely was complimentary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, so the truth is probably somewhere
in the middle,
in the middle, or maybe one side of the middle, but from what if you're comparing to other situations like this in the West, I'm sure. Well, I know one thing. I know, like, if it was a military outfit like Custer at the Washita, you take the women and the children captive. So you would, I mean, women and children were undoubtedly killed.
Yeah.
But a lot of times the key was to take them captive. But then you get like what happened at Sand Creek or Wounded Knee, which is much different. So it's like, which is it?
So this is going on in March of 1863.
Right.
What happened in December of 1863?
Oh, Bear Creek.
Bear River.
Bear River.
Yeah, the Bear River Massacre.
Which was a battle, and then it was a massacre.
Yeah, but that, I mean, there's pretty clear evidence that soldiers indiscriminately killed women and children during that battle, right?
Yeah, after when the warriors were all either killed or hiding and there was nothing to be done to defend, they killed women and children.
Yeah. So from Mayfield, they go back up toward the basin. There's one of their numbers is injured slightly. Well, actually not slightly, because he dies later. So he's mortally wounded.
Right.
Shorten this up. After that, the party splits. Part goes to the Malheur River in eastern Oregon. The other part goes down the Snake River toward Three Island Crossing in Bruneau area. And then they go down into the Owyhees. So Jeff goes west into Oregon, and it's another kind of similar battle with the Malheur Indians there. That's where you get where they captured the native boy who is given to Kelly, the violinist, and the kid becomes a contortionist while Kelly plays the violin. Yeah. And it's this weird thing because they go over to Europe and they tour around Europe and Ireland and all stuff. So that's kind of an interesting aside. When we talked about Chief Bigfoot and his confession, he talks about how his wife was killed and his child was stolen by Stanifer. So it kind of connects that together. Those two, that's an episode we did a couple months back.
I remember, so yeah.
That kind of connects. And then the party that goes down into the Owyhees near Silver City, there's actually, I think in Haley's History of Idaho, he talks about they first found the ore that started the Silver City Rush on this expedition. I don't know how true that is, though. That doesn't seem, because I've heard about Michael Jordan finding the ore later on. So I don't know. Anyway, they fight another battle with the natives there. And so you have these three kind of major battles with the Shoshone Bannock.
Well, much like mining, Rangers. When you're trying to understand history like this or come to some sort of understanding of what actually happened, you're heaping through tons of bullshit to get to a kernel of gold in there. right. You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of accounts, a lot of details. I don't think I just have a feeling that there's some more out there somewhere that kind of will tie more together, but hopefully I'll find some more in the future.
Right. I mean, so whether Jefferson Stanifer was some murderous, rampaging, you know, tool of genocide, or if he was just like a lot of other Westerners, he'd kill native peoples for sure. So, but maybe not target all women and children. You know, who knows?
It's hard to say, yeah. And I was split like during my whole time researching this of what actually happened. I don't know.
Well, so regardless, you know, having this rather successful, at least militarily speaking, armed militia with members probably of both Union and Southern supporters, the Army orders Stanifer's men to disperse. Yeah.
So Lieutenant Colonel at the time, Luganbill, he came to the Boise Valley with two sets of orders. One of them was to build Fort Boise,
right,
establish that. And the other order was to disband Stanifer's Rangers. And the orders, it actually refers to them as a secessionist militia, armed secessionist militia. So it makes sense, you know, you can't have an armed militia if you're establishing a military presence in that area.
Right. I mean, they wanted to protect people pioneers on the trail, in the sense that they wanted a Union supporters or people who would be future, you know, Americans to homestead the West. But they also, more importantly, wanted to protect those gold shipments, I would imagine, and all that coming out of there. But yeah, in the middle of this, you can't have secessionists just rabble-rousing around there with their guns.
Right.
So let's move on with Jefferson Stanford's tale. So he goes aboard from here. He leaves the Idaho Territory to go back to California.
It's interesting timing that you have federal troops roll into town, and then he leaves shortly after. I don't know if that's a coincidence or if he did that on purpose.
Yeah, but he takes a steamship to California regardless. And what does he do when he gets there?
He meets with a guy named Captain Kennedy. And Captain Kennedy is like I mentioned briefly before, he is a spy for the Confederate States of America. There's a whole narrative of Kennedy that he wrote down later on. And then this narrative is actually kind of partially verified by a guy who's pretty famous in Western lore, famous outlaw. You remember who that was?
Plummer?
No. Cousin of Jesse James.
Oh, Cole Younger.
Cole Younger wrote. Boy. Yeah, so he was Jesse James' cousin, and then they combined their gangs later on to become the James Younger gang.
Right.
They robbed a lot of stuff together.
Great 70s band.
Yeah.
James Gang?
Oh, yeah. Never heard of it.
What?
No. Is it like Leonard Skinner?
It's like a much lesser Leonard Skinner.
Okay.
No, that's a different band. Okay. Mississippi Queen. No, that's a totally different band.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Well, is that the story? Get my Mountain Dew. Sweet Home Alabama was on the radio, so Leonard Skinner's on my mind anyway.
I love how everybody you could have people in like Berkeley, California, and Sweet Home Alabama come on, and you get like patchouli smelling hippies with their hemp hair.
So Kennedy, he's escorted through from Texas to through Mexico by Cole Younger and some of his friends.
Cole Older?
Yeah. natural gas, the wiser? I don't know. so goes to California. And then, like I said before, he goes up to British Columbia to deliver this order for this commerce raider to be delivered to Southern sympathizers in British Columbia. I forgot to mention that in British Columbia at this time, there's actually the Confederate flag flying from flagpoles at the time. So that's how many Southern sympathizers there were in British Columbia.
Wow.
So after this, Kennedy, he goes down back to California. Then he goes over to Virginia City, Nevada, and he's helping to – there's this whole – and I dedicated a whole chapter in my book. I'm not going to go too far into it. But there was this plan to basically connect the Confederacy to California via an overland road through what would be New Mexico and Arizona. Uh-huh. Like I said – if you're interested in this, read my book because I lay it all out there. Kennedy was kind of on the forefront of going to Virginia City and seeing how many pro-Confederate men he could find there to help open this road to
in Nevada.
Right. Yeah. And so he's found out by federal troops there, and he gets chased back to San Francisco, and he hides out in the hills for a while, and then he and Jeff stand for meat. It's very serendipitous. And again, I think it feels to me like that wasn't an accident that they met. The details aren't recorded, but there's a union or a government detective at this time named Gustav Brown. And he writes about this club. He calls it a club of men that are helping get people from California through Mexico back to Texas to join the Confederate Army. Kennedy and Stanifer are these people that are helping, or at least Stanifer is at this time. He's helping men get back to Texas to join the Confederate Army. Okay. So he hooks up with Kennedy. They travel together. They get, and again, they're like dressed up as miners and, you know, they're trying to hide their true identities from the Mexican officials. Mexico during this time is very fractured because of the French interdiction in Mexico. They had probably a fairly clear pass to move through that area without too much harassment or too much worry from the Mexicans. But they get to within the side of the Rio Grande and they're ambushed by a Union patrol. There's a firefight. The group is pretty much scattered. Stanifer and Kennedy survive. They get back to Texas and they report to Kennedy's commanding officer, Colonel Pyron. And basically Kennedy says that, hey, Stanifer performed well. He's, you know, he is very brave in battle. So
this is a firefight between Union and Confederate supporters, at least in Mexico?
In Mexico, just south of the Texas border.
Holy shnikey.
And my question on this is, why was there a Union patrol in Mexico? That didn't quite make sense to me, but they're near Eagle Pass, Texas, which if you know where Eagle Pass is, it's right on the border. There's a private prison there now. That's why I know where it is. But so they're pretty close to there.
So there's plots and scheming going on in California and Arizona because they want Arizona to be a Confederate state.
Yeah.
Right. And so this is one of the KGC's major goals, right, is to flip Arizona to be a Western state pro-Confederate.
So Arizona is kind of similar to Missouri at the time, where it started off very Confederate and then it was occupied by Union troops. And then the Arizonans, they had their own government in exile in Texas at the time.
Right. That was surprising. It sounded like it was at first Confederate.
Yeah.
And then that the Union goes in and then it flips, but it was kind of officially Confederate at first.
Yeah.
You don't hear like that come to talk. Like, what are the Confederate states? You don't hear Arizona.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that is interesting. Okay. So, all right. So after, you know, the overland road that they were going to open and Jeff secreting possible soldiers for the Confederacy back in his days with Kennedy, the war is over. His days with the KGC are behind him, kind of, maybe.
Possibly. Maybe there's some other conspiracy theories and stuff around the KGC that we could get into a little bit here at the end.
Well, that's so interesting. He goes to Montana, but invests in Mexico.
Yeah, and this is kind of something that's really blurry to me because I can't find any deed claims or anything in Mexico, but him and one of his brothers, probably Buford Preston, BP of Sanford, they invested in a mine in Mexico, and that was caught up in the strife that was going on, the Mexican Civil War that was going on, the French intervention that was going on at the time. There's an account from an old prospector when Stanford ends up passing away. He tells the story that Jeff told him, and that all the Mexican miners were slaughtered, and Jeff and his brother had to escape basically during the night. And then, yeah, after that, they're up in like Montana, Wyoming.
When I hear Mexican mine, I think of Young Guns.
Yeah.
The old Mexican Blackbird. You know, and they're like, it turns out like, oh, Schmitty, Mexican Blackbird is just a she's a whore down there in Fort Worth or something, like, I don't know. Classic. Great, actually one of the more historically accurate movies. I was surprised. An 80s Western is actually one of the most historically accurate ones.
I mean, Emilio Estevez has never steered me wrong.
I think he's perfectly cast, man. Yeah. Charlie Sheen was originally going to get that part.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise is in the end of that movie. He wanted to get shot in a Western because he's Tom Cruise.
Okay.
You just see Tom Cruise get shot.
To let him do whatever he wants.
I love seeing him get shot. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Young Guns is great.
Yes. Watch it.
Okay. Anyway. So, I digress. he is in Montana, but there's these Mexican mines that he's kind of invested in. But he forms something out of Montana called the Wind River Expedition,
yeah,
with mining in mind in the end, as the end goal there.
Right, yeah. So the Wind River range is actually in Wyoming. And he goes to Montana first, and then he's in Wyoming for a little bit. So the Wind River Expedition, also known as the Yellowstone Expedition. And so during this time, Yellowstone was just kind of being explored and set up. It was set up as a national park like pretty early on, like the 1870s or something, right?
Right. We're not talking about, oh no, I'm thinking the Black Hills Expedition of Custer. Never mind.
Yeah, that's so, a little east.
But the Yellowstone Expedition, okay.
Yeah, so this is a wild story. I'm going to try to break this down really quickly. So they go to the Wind River Mountains, they're doing some prospecting, and then, there's a journal. This journal is, it's written by his lieutenant on this expedition, a guy named Bart Henderson. And Henderson's writing this journal, and Granville Stewart, who was a pretty famous guy from Montana, he was one of the vigilantes of Montana. So he actually transcribed the journal later on, so there's some notes on it from Granville Stewart.
Right.
It's kind of an interesting connection.
What was it, like Stewart's or Stranville's?
Stewart Stranglers.
Stewart Stranglers was the vigilante squad. Oh, that's a nasty name, isn't it?
You got to love the alliteration on that.
Oh, right.
So they're mining in the prospect. They're prospecting. They're not mining. They're just prospecting. They're trying to find and set up new gold mines.
Right.
Which they find a little bit of gold here and there. But it's weird because all of a sudden they start heading south. Just without explanation in the Henderson diary, they just head south. And so they travel through what's now eastern Idaho and down into Utah. They get north of Salt Lake City, and Henderson in his diary says, "We are now recruiting in earnest for Mexico." But he doesn't say why they're going to Mexico. So it's very weird, right? They get down into Salt Lake City. They've been out in the boonies and the country, backcountry, for weeks at this point. So they get their party on.
In Salt Lake City.
In Salt Lake City, of all places. Henderson says they wind up in the Calaboose, so they go to jail. They're partying so hard.
All the 3% beer you can drink.
Yeah.
Have like 10 of them is equivalent to one or
something. Okay, so hot take, but this is back when the Mormons could actually drink alcohol.
No way!
Yeah, you know that?
The thing?
Yeah. It's a whole thing. Word of wisdom.
Now you can't drink caffeine.
They can drink caffeine, but not coffee.
I thought What?
Yeah.
Well, weird. Because from what I read, the church invested in like.
That's not true.
Pepsi.
Yeah. That's a myth that's gone around for
but
a long time.
But then why can they drink caffeinated soda but not coffee? Coffee's actually cleaner than soda.
So the way the revelation from Jehovah reads is that they can't drink hot drinks. Hot drinks at the time would refer to coffee and tea.
So they can't drink tea.
Right.
Now they can't drink tea?
They can't drink black tea, green tea. They can drink herbal tea.
But that's hot.
They can't drink hot chocolate.
What the fuck?
Yes, thank you.
I mean, when
it's all contradictory.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. To say just Mormonism isn't the other only religion that sounds outlandish to me. Right. I'm going to be biased here, but I am not a religious person.
Yeah.
But still, that's kind of getting a little too controlling, I would say, of people's. If you're telling me I can't drink coffee or tea or whatever, I'm like, fuck this religion. I'm out.
What if they told you what underwear to wear?
Well, if they're about the thong.
They're certainly not.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, no.
Okay. Anyway, moving on.
Okay.
So speaking of Mormons, there's this weird thing where they're camped north of Salt Lake City. And the day that Jeff Stanifer arrives, because he kind of leads, he goes out in front of the camp to Salt Lake City. There's this doctor that's murdered. And there's a land dispute that's involved in it. And it's so weird that Stanifer, because it's like the big thing in Salt Lake City at the time, like the big news, right? Some people think that Brigham Young had him killed because of this hospital that this doctor had built.
And he's a Gentile.
He's a Gentile, yeah. And yeah, so that's a whole weird thing. And I've researched that as much as I could, and I can't find any answers. It seems like maybe Stanifer was involved, but I can't say that for sure.
Right.
Anyway, so they do their partying, like I said, and then the camp moves on. So they're down south of Salt Lake City, and all of a sudden there's a messenger that shows up in camp, and he wants to talk to someone in charge. He gives him an invitation to go talk to Brigham Young. So Henderson goes and he sits in Brigham Young's office, and Brigham basically asks Henderson what they're doing. Why are you going to Mexico? And in the journal, he tells Brigham Young, President Young, the supposed prophet of the Lord, what they're going to do in Mexico, but he doesn't detail that in the journal, unfortunately. But he fills in Brigham with the details. Brigham is, according to Henderson, supportive of whatever this plan is. And I'll tell you what my theory is here in a minute of what they're going to do in Mexico. So he actually offers to give the Stanifer's company supplies to complete their trip. Henderson says, oh, we've got enough supplies, we're good. So he gives them opera tickets to the opera that night instead. So
sounds like a Sicilian mob movie. He's like, I'll give you a little bit of my... Yeah. Okay, get some opera tickets. Hey, I'm
up and down. Something like that, yeah. So anyway, the expedition continues on. There's a lot of interesting, cool stuff that happens in there. Henderson breaks his leg. His stagecoach crashes or falls through a bridge. Ah. So he breaks his leg, and then he's nursed back to health by these Mormon ladies, and he almost marries one. And anyway, so
why stop there?
Right. Yeah. Right. And then like they're going down through Arizona, and there's they get attacked by natives down there. And there's when they're up in like Wyoming, Montana area, they get attacked by natives up there too. So like this whole big, exciting journey that they're on. Right.
And Stanifer's on this thing.
Stanifer is in charge of this thing.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's the funny thing. Other people are writing about this, but not...
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Can't find anything written by Stanifer himself, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So they get to Fort Yuma, or Henderson gets to Fort Yuma, and he says he's supposed to meet some other people from Los Angeles there in Fort Yuma. That's where the journal ends.
Oh, man.
And it's so frustrating because he doesn't say why they're going to Mexico. So here's my theory. Ready for this?
Yes.
I'm going to try to lay this out as quick as I can. This could be a whole podcast series. So basically, the French intervention in Mexico was because Mexico owed debts to Europe for their revolution, right?
Yep.
So the British, the Spanish, and the French, they land in Mexico to go get this money back. The British and Spanish kind of lose interest, and they leave the French there.
Right.
So Napoleon... I can't remember which emperor. This is the third.
Yeah.
He's looking around and he's like, well, we fought these fights. This is where the Battle of Pueblo or Cinco de Mayo. That's right. Where this happens, right? So Napoleon's like, well, we've had some successes. We now own most of Mexico. There's still a lot of fighting, like I mentioned before, with Benito Juarez. He's the opposing party against the French. Yeah. And it's like it's basically a civil war, but the French are there and they're helping one side.
And these colonial powers essentially have been funding the war, and since Benito Juarez, the government can't pay him back, they invade.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So they take over Mexico City, and the French and their Mexican allies, they basically are the rulers of the country for a while. They push Juarez and his people up to the northwest of Mexico, so the Baja Sonora area. Napoleon needs a leader, though, and he gets this guy named
Maximilian.
The guy almost said Archduke Ferdinand. That's a whole different thing.
That's another, Austrian. Yeah. It's going to get us into some deep shit.
So Maximilian's this Austrian prince.
Right.
And Napoleon and his people basically say, hey, come be an emperor in Mexico. It takes some finagling, some convincing, but eventually Maximilian goes to Mexico and becomes the emperor of Mexico.
He sounds like a dipshit that meant well.
Yeah.
Like he actually tried to be nice, you know?
He was very book smart. He was into the sciences and he was a naval officer. So he was a pretty capable, smart guy. But I think he was duped by the French to actually do this.
And he was totally wealthy and lived in this huge bubble where he's like, of course they would want me.
So speaking of wealth, the story goes is after some time, Benito Juarez's forces, they take back Mexico City, capture Maximilian, and they take him and his top generals out and execute him.
Right.
That's the established historical story. Now here comes the more conspiratorial kind of aspect of this. There's a lot of people who believe that Maximilian survived this firing squad attempt. And it's a lot like Princess Anastasia of Russia, right, where he goes on and he survives. And then here's where we get really heavy in the conspiratorial stuff. Jesse James, the notorious outlaw, was supposedly charged by the Knights of the Golden Circle to go down to Mexico and secure Maximilian's treasury. So the interesting thing about this is this was going on at the same exact time Stauffer and his men were headed toward Mexico. Okay, so he could have been headed down to try to protect his mining interests, or he could have been involved in that attempt to get that treasury.
Or both.
Or both.
Or one.
Or, yeah. Or you could have just gone for some tacos. We don't know, right?
I don't know. You want to go to the best place.
Yeah.
For tacos.
Exactly. Yeah. We do know that after the war, there was Confederate general, and a lot of Confederate people actually went down and colonized in Mexico for a while. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. So that's kind of where that portion of Stauffer's story ends, and that leaves so many questions.
I hope the people in Mexico, when they're like, this is the Confederate enclave or whatever settlement, I hope they told people with a nice dark tan not to go near there. Yeah. If you have a good tan, just veer away from that place, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's some descendants of them still down there,
It
feels like. I mean, obviously you have the FLDS people that have gone down there instead of colonies. So it seems like the place to go if you want to set up a weird cult
colony. Well, Jonestown was a little farther down there in Guyana, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So this crazy story of Jesse James saving Maximilian, perhaps Stauffer was down there. Perhaps Stauffer saved Maximilian.
Perhaps Stauffer was Jesse James. There's this weird theory that Jesse James was actually many different people, and that Jesse James or people with the initials JJ were posing as Jesse James.
Okay.
Because he was so prolific, some people think that he couldn't have done all this. And Jeff Stauffer, I don't think you mentioned this, his middle name was J, There's middle initials J, so JJ, you know, Jesse Jane. You know, it's one of those weird, crazy things.
I think it's probably BS, but, you know, it is an interesting story.
Though. It is, yeah. And we'll talk kind of more of that conspiracy aspect here toward the end.
Okay, so despite this interesting story and his time in Mexico, where does Jeff go after Mexico?
Back to Wyoming.
Back to Wyoming. Secluded Wyoming.
Right. So he does some more mining. He ends up in a place called Bear River City, which is kind of, it's a complete ghost town now, but it was on the border of Utah and Wyoming, kind of in the mountainous, off the Bear River, basically. Okay. All right. He has a saloon there for a little while. And he, you know, he's relegating people with the stories of his adventures. There's a painting in Bear in his saloon of his fight with the Snake Indians in the Idaho territory region.
I was thinking, like, where is that? And then you're like, oh, it's gone, burned.
Yeah, burned. So there, it's a really fascinating story. Bear River City was burned in what they called a riot, but it was basically because there's vigilantes who tried to arrest some bad dudes, and they fought back, and then the town, including the saloon and that painting, were lost.
Oh, man.
So.
All right. So he's in Wyoming, and he's not done yet. He's a packer on something called the Mills Expedition through Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And he meets a certain somebody, perhaps. Or at least there's no record of it, but at least they are kind of doing the same thing at the same time. So it makes sense that they would at least know each other.
So the Mills Expedition was basically, you had this incident where the natives entered the parade grounds at several forts. Fort Steele, and then a couple other forts in the area.
Right.
And slaughtered soldiers, right? So the Mills Expedition was punishment expedition.
Was it Fetterman?
Fetterman, maybe.
Fort Fetterman?
Yeah.
Is that there was the Fetterman Massacre, but that was the Sioux in the 60s during Red Cloud's War.
So this was later on. This is the 70s.
Yeah. Okay. So now that one. But Fort Fetterman was a fort at that time.
Yeah. These forts were established to protect the railroad.
Right.
That was coming through the area. So Fort Steele was, it was there to protect a railroad trestle bridge that goes over the Platte River. So Fort Steele, I didn't answer your question. So this expedition that are going on, Jeff is the chief packer. And then the chief guide was a guy named William Cody, also known as Buffalo Bill, right? Mm-hmm. So this, they had to have connected or had to have interacted. You have the chief guide and the chief packer. I'm sure they talked and helped plan together. So they go out, they leave from Fort Steele. Somewhere along the way, Jeff reports that he's feeling ill. So they take him back to Fort Steele, put him up in the hospital, and he dies a couple days later. He dies of, according to the newspaper, it was Rocky Mountain fever. Spread by the ticks, mm-hmm. Yeah. So he dies there at Fort Steele. He's buried in it's called the Post Cemetery. Mm-hmm. So as you, I don't know how it looked back in the day, obviously, but there's a main road as you drive into Fort Steele on the right side, there's the Post Cemetery, and then you kind of go down and there's a powder magazine. And then there's like a couple other buildings. There's a big building that's like the visitor center. And then you cross you walk underneath the train trestle bridge, and then the whole fort is laid out right there in front of you. The parade ground, the barracks, the blacksmith shop, the stable, all that.
Oh, cool.
So it's really cool to visit. If you're ever driving through central Wyoming, definitely worth a stop. So he dies there in the hospital. I got to visit Fort Steele two summers ago now, and
That long ago?
Yeah, it was a while ago. So I got to visit the grave, and this is after I published the first edition of my book. I actually left a copy of that book in the visitor center. It was kind of cool. I might have a rock from his grave actually in my drawer right here.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so Jeff's dead.
Yes.
Jeff's dead. He led an extraordinary life. What, he was in his 30s when he died?
He was young, yeah. I think around 34. So this would have been the 1870s.
So if he's born in 1834, 44, 54, 64, yeah, okay. So he's in his mid-30s, late, or almost 40.
Yeah, 1871 is when he died. So yeah, he's a young man. Incredible, like, everything that he did. Like you said, like, guesstimated one time, and he had to have done over 3,000 miles on his horse, you know, well, in the West.
To get this down to Idaho, I think I'll ask you about this first. He obviously, whether he was a murderous plainsman or mountain man or whatever, or, you know, just the leader of a militia that's going out to stop, you know, what he sees as depredations by the quote-unquote snake Indians. You know, he had an impact on Idaho. Do you think he, without him, Idaho would be different? Do you think he was part of something that would have happened anyway?
I don't think it would have been different. I think it just would have developed later. Okay. On. We talked about last episode, Jane Silcott and her helping Pierce get onto the Nez Perce Reservation. That would have happened anyway.
All right.
The Boise Basin, Boise City would have developed anyway. But without Stanford and his leadership and what he did, it would have developed later. Maybe, you know, it was spring, so maybe, you know, 6 months later, maybe they would have waited a fall to get someone that had the leadership capabilities and had the chutzpah to actually go out and engage in this. So I don't think, you know, we need to erect a statue to Jeff Stanford for what he did in the Boise area, but I certainly think he should be remembered for, you know, what happened.
Yeah, there. I think he's an interesting character in the sense that at least for the few people that know about him, or the people in history that know about him, you know, he's one of those characters where we have a person that we know on social media that is just, I would say they know a lot about historic things, but they're not a historian. Mm-hmm. And fly off the handle anytime you mention anything about this guy, Jeff Stanford.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's whether he was good or bad is, well, that's part of his story. But you talk about people who are bad all the time.
Yeah.
You talk about people who are good all the time. It's trying to figure out why they were seen as bad or good.
Yeah.
You know, what sides were defining them, what they actually did, placing them in that time and place. And, like, he's a fascinating character. So I was definitely more on the, like, I've heard he's a horrible, horrible genocidal guy. And then I heard the opposite from other people. And so now he's just, I think his belief system was asinine and ridiculous. But there's also some stuff to admire about this guy. And he was brave.
Yeah, as a lion.
As a lion, right? And, you know, whether you think he, you know, slaughtered innocent native and children and women, which, you know, I'm sure people on that trip did.
Yeah.
But he also proved himself as a very capable leader of men. And, you know, these people that you don't know quite how to define are very interesting. You know, you don't know where to place them. So you continually want to, which makes it more interesting because you just can't quite do it.
Yeah. When he passed away, all of the newspaper items about him were very complimentary of him and his life. Not only what he did, but his character as well. There's a maybe we should go back a little bit and talk about one more incident that happened back in Idaho, specifically the Horseshoe Bend. You remember the story with Nina, yeah, the native?
Yeah.
So there's a guy who was the fifth mayor of Portland, who was headed up, his name was Robbins. He was headed up to mine in the basin, and they're camped outside of Horseshoe Bend waiting for the snow to melt so they could get up the, what's that, Harris Creek Ranch Road now.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it has it's a cool way to go into Idaho City.
It's a very cool way.
Placerville. It goes right to Placerville.
It's very cool to drive that in the winter in a Ford Focus.
Yeah, right. That too.
I don't recommend that. I did that once.
Right, yeah. Anyway, I've only taken my truck up there. But
yeah, that's recommended.
Right.
So Robbins, he sees this packer, and this packer is beating this native girl mercilessly. And so he intervenes. The packer's like, well, you can have her, but you have to pay me for her. And he pays her like 2 bits, I think.
Right.
I can't remember. It was like a very, like 2 gold coins or whatever. Is the price of a horse, you know, so you're equating a horse to human life at that
right.
point. Anyway, so Robbins, he saves this girl, this native girl. He calls for Nina, and Nina's sister's around too. So Nina and her sister are in the camp at Horseshoe Bend with them. And then they go, as they're going up into the basin, Nina tries to escape. She gets away, but she comes back because she recognized Robbins was trying to help her. And then they go into the basin, they're mining. Nina's living with Robbins. Sorry to back up. When the packer sold the girl to Robbins that night, he comes back. He's like, I want her back.
Right.
Sure, for various unscrupulous reasons. Right. But Stanford, he's camped right next to Robbins, and he hears this exchange, and he says to Robbins, you know, if you resist him, there's going to be a fight. And Robbins is like, well, I'm committed to saving her, to helping her. So Jeff stands up, and he stands up to this packer, and he says, if you're not 3 gulches over by the morning, you're going to be hung from the nearest tree.
Right.
So Stanford, like, he's trying to do the right thing in that incident. Robbins wasn't complimentary to Stanford at all. He actually called him like a murderous. He talks about his rangers and how they were murdering natives, but he talks about Stanford helping him in that situation. And then later on in the basin, Nina disappears several times. She's kidnapped. And Stanford actually goes and helps get her back and gets her back so she can go back to live with Robbins. So that story's in my book as well. So I definitely think it's hard to take a character like Stanford. And like you said, you can't make a moral judgment one way or the other on a man like this because he's on both sides, right?
Well, you can place him in both, you know, the major conflict that was the overall Indian Wars, quote unquote, and the Civil War. And while I think in both cases he was definitely on the wrong side, those are major kind of events to define somebody under, right?
Yeah.
I think he was on the wrong side in the Civil War, but at the same time, people on the wrong side could do stand up things.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could have people on wrong sides that do good things for other people. And then, you know, what would Jefferson Stanford have looked at when he looks at a Shoshone person? What would he have seen in his eyes? What would he have labeled him as? Probably a threat. A threat to his financial well-being, a threat to the lives of him up in the basin, a threat to, you know, the spread of society, white society. I don't know, but he was
to his life and to the life of
right.
his fellow people, his right. white fellow whiteies. Right. Later on, when he was in Wyoming, the Wind River area, he actually is friends to the Snake Indians.
Right.
At that
That's
time.
Another thing, yeah.
So it's definitely a time and it's a place that you have to take in consideration.
Which is something that, you know, I think in history we focus on the Sioux of the Great Plains or, you know, the Lakota or the Cheyenne, you know, of the plains as well, the Southern Plains. But we don't focus on them outside of like this time period when the Americans were really fighting them, right?
Yeah.
We're talking the 1876 Sioux War particularly, but Red Clouds War, stuff like that. But it doesn't really get into the complexities of, yeah, you're going to be enemies with a certain people later. But like the Nez Perce, at this time, they're your allies.
Yeah.
And they don't like the Sioux.
Right.
So they're fighting the Sioux or the Lakota. Mm-hmm.
And then the Crow helped the Crow, army defeat right, the Nez Perce.
Right. And then the Nez Perce are trying to run to the Crows after during 1877.
Yeah.
And so it's like this moving kind of the alliances. That doesn't change the fact that this was a, you know, culturally genocidal move and many argue just genocide in this larger sense.
Right.
But it doesn't change that fact. But it's just much more complicated on Earth, but I tend to think that we just kind of stereotype, you know, the people that don't really read into it that much, watch a documentary, that this is what the Plains Wars or the wars in the West were like with Native Americans, and it's not that simple. You know, and you might have a member of a militia that goes and kills a whole group of Nez Perce, let's say, in one skirmish. Or you might have somebody that doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, so in an environment of great wrong, you can have somebody that I overall think was wrong do something that was stand up, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I guess my answer is that there's no simple definition here or
label. Right. Should we talk about that headstone?
Jeff Standifer dies and he's buried at Fort Steele, Wyoming. For a long time, he didn't have a gravestone, right? Or a marker.
Yeah, he had a little square that was actually added later that says 39 on it. Because that corresponded to how they laid out the cemetery, like his plot number, I guess.
But no, nothing naming who he was or his allegiances or anything like that. And so then along comes this 21st century Confederate Legion that you're trying to figure out who these guys are, but there's a marker on his grave that these people placed sometime in the, last 15 years?
Yeah, as far as I can tell.
And it's got a little Confederate flag up in this corner of a rectangle, and this Confederate flag is in a square at the corner of the rectangle. It's got his name, and it's got, what is it, the California Confederate whatever?
First California
Confederate
Cavalry Battalion, I believe. Battalion. I mean, it's all like abbreviated, but I think that's what that stands for.
So you're sitting here going, who's the 21st century Confederate Legion and what's this cavalry unit that they're talking about?
Yeah. So I had known about Standifer from my old podcast. We talked about the Snake War and what he did there. And then I was kind of interested in him. So I was doing some more searches and I found Find a Grave.
Right.
And I saw a picture of that stone.
Weird.
And yeah, it's so weird because why is this guy who's buried in Wyoming, who did all this stuff in Idaho, like why is he buried with the Confederate flag, you know? So that's kind of what started my mind turning and questioning. And then, yeah, the 21st century Confederate Legion, the first California Confederate Cavalry. I can tell you that the first California Confederate Cavalry Battalion did not exist officially ever. Like,
right.
We even went so far to talk to the California Military History Museum. They, like, the guy who was in charge of that is very knowledgeable. He's like, I've never heard of this. I mean, it might be this, or this. So I explore some options in my book. Like the Los Angeles Long Rifles who left California, went back to the Confederacy and joined up the army there. It didn't make sense because Standifer was in Idaho while that was happening.
And I'm assuming you looked this up in the old papers.
Yeah.
Many, many times.
Oh, yeah.
And I know you did.
Searched the internet.
There's nothing.
All these books. Reached out to the subject matter expert. And there's nothing.
And so in doing so, you also track down this 21st Confederate Legion, and it sounds like a very loose kind of, we have the same objective, but you could have a very sane person that just wants to, you know, put a marker on a Confederate soldier's grave, sometimes for the purpose of history, to these people that are like, all up into the lost cause.
The South will rise again.
Ideology. And then some people are like, look, we're trying to organize an army to bring about the old South again.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's what with me is like somebody like Jefferson Standifer, you know, you get these people that take up this idea of the lost cause and all these things and, you know, use him as this character that he wasn't necessarily, you know, to prop up this idea of a lost cause.
But they're just marking his grave. They're not, like, promoting this at all. Okay. And that's the weird thing. There's no website for this 21st century Confederate Legion. There's no Facebook page, Instagram, no social, no internet presence. Can't even find a phone number, address. Well, I found an address later, but it took some work to find that. And yeah, so it's so weird that an organization like this, because there's two other organizations, the Sons of Confederate Veterans and then the Daughters of the Confederacy. That's what they do, is they identify graves and then they submit that information to the government to apply for a government headstone.
Right.
This isn't that. This is these people making their own or having them made and marking them themselves. Most of these headstones are centered in the South, especially Florida at the Key West Cemetery. There's, I can't remember how many are there. I corresponded with the sexton of the cemetery. And he told me this kind of wild story. Like, there's a guy out painting headstones. And
can you imagine?
Yeah.
Like, my goodness.
And so if you look up the 21st Century Confederate Legion on the internet, you'll find photos of these markers next to often their original headstone. And then it'll say something similar, 21st Century Confederate Legion, the name of the person. Normally, it doesn't have a unit designator on there, though, which is kind of weird that Standard First does, especially that unit didn't exist. And then I had some theories, right? Oh, and I should probably mention, not only are they marking these graves of these different people, they actually have a marker on the place where John Wilkes Booth was killed at Fort A.P. Hill. And I contacted the army, because it's army property. I'm like, hey, what's the deal with this? I actually put a FOIA request in on this. Huh. I got a kind of half-assed response back that they didn't know what was the deal with it was. So, so I'm still like, I don't know who these people are. And again, like, I'm trying to come up with all the theories that you just listed. Are they just wackadoodles? Are they people who are earnest and trying to mark history, that type of thing? And so I get down to it and I find this, this 20-some-year-old post on Ancestry.com, and it's someone asking for an address to the 21st Century Confederate Legion because they marked this person's ancestor's grave and they wanted to thank them. They didn't get a response, but then they responded like 2 years later and said, hey, I found this address. And so it had a name. And
a Rademacher. Yeah, I thought you were saying about the guy's grave.
No. So it had this name, Rademacher, that was connected to this address. So what I did is I sent a letter to that address, got it back, returned to sender, not applicable address, whatever. But then I found an address for this Rademacher guy. And so I started corresponding with him, and his letters, like, did I ever show you them? They're like they're like a letter an old person writes.
Cause he was old.
He was old. Like, he was taking old envelopes and writing on them. Cause you know how people that lived through the Depression, like, they save stuff. They don't throw stuff away. They reuse it. Which is admirable, you know, reuse, reduce, recycle. Right.
Right.
But yeah. And he describes how he's basically has dementia. He doesn't really remember that much, but he indicates in his first couple of letters that he was involved in this organization. So I'm writing back, I'm asking all these questions. And then there's a long period of time where my letters don't get responded to, but they don't get returned to me. So I'm like, what, did he die? You know, does he have a family member intercepting him? So I tried again, like a year later, and he responds, and he's like, the 21st Century Confederate Legion sounds like an interesting organization. What if we had something like, and it's like his memory of it was just completely gone. So it's like, okay, I'm not getting any more from this old fella, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. This actually presented me with the most kind of conflicting, I guess, positions in my own mind. I think Confederate soldiers' graves should be marked. I definitely do. It's a piece of history. Many of them were poor, and they didn't own slaves, though they were fighting for, well, many times the wealthy that did own slaves, but not all slave owners were, you know, or people who enslaved others were wealthy.
Right.
But I still think they fought for a deplorable thing. But they also, if you read what they wrote, many of them were fighting because, as they saw it, their land was invaded by the Union. You know, Jefferson Standifer is a little different. He comes from the South, moves out west, far fringe of the South, believes in this order of the
Knights of the Golden,
Knights of the Golden Circle. So he must have believed in their overall ideology, like, you know, we laid out here.
So I didn't talk about all the evidence that I have that points him as being a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. Yeah, so it's not 100% certain, but it's pretty clear.
Yeah, it's a, other than like the dotting of the I and the crossing of the T, I mean, yeah, it's pretty much clear. But, you know, he fought for this kind of idea of spreading slavery, you know, if that's what he was thinking on the ground, this overall ideology. So in the end, I can't be like, I want to memorialize this man, but I do think for this case of being a very interesting person in history, you can do a lot with his story to teach quite a few different things about history and a man like him and where he's coming from. So I think he should be marked and I guess memorialized, but not, I don't want to pay tribute to it. Mm-hmm. Like your own, he's a guy that really kind of you can be in awe of if he went through so much and did so much. But at the same time, I don't want to, I guess, pay tribute to him in my own mind.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, it's a fine line to walk.
Yeah.
You know, it, which is this whole Civil War.
Yeah.
The whole Civil War. I mean, he's one example of, you know, the fine line to walk in the Civil War is that it's much more complicated on the ground. I mean, the Confederacy is fighting for the preservation of slave states that can support slavery, but that's not the overall drive for many on the ground, yeah, that are, you know, probably your non-coms and below, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like...
It's hard.
I'm going to piss off a whole bunch of people with all that, but that's what I believe.
Yeah.
That's what I think the evidence has taken me to. What do you feel about what Jefferson Stand For represents? You got a lot of editing to do on this episode.
I do, yeah. We're at an hour and a half already. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I tried with my story, I try not to glorify his actions, especially because the whole, you know, the whole his sympathies to the South and what he was doing for the South, that's kind of a question mark to me still. Like, I don't have any hard and fast evidence that that's what he was doing. He certainly killed Indians. Like, there's no qualms about that.
Right.
And I don't glorify that. Unlike a certain person who's not a historian but talks about history a lot. Thinks I did. I didn't read the book.
Right. I mean, our friend Bob Hartman, who runs the 30,000+ Boise history page, 1863 to present, said it was a well-balanced book.
Yeah.
And that guy lives and breathes Idaho history.
Yeah, he does.
You know.
Yeah.
He's also a nice, balanced, sane human being.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, he's great. But yeah, like, so I try not to glorify what he did. I try to present that as this is the story. This is what these sources say happened. I hope people, if they do listen to this, if they haven't turned this off by now, or if they have read my book or want to read my book, I hope they just keep it to kind of open mind and think of the picture as a whole and not focus on certain aspects of it like that.
Right.
Because this is the story of early Idaho. It really is. Like,
right.
You don't get called a builder of Idaho without right. you being of some importance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times you got to get away from right and wrong, just to analyze the person, and then you can come up with that after.
Yeah. I mean, we put a lot of our own view on people that don't deserve it, whether it's historical figures or people nowadays. Like, we put our own things onto people.
Well, one thing I find interesting is, you know, like Robert E. Lee said, don't memorialize me. Essentially,
yeah.
We lost, and then he's on the face of a stone mountain.
Yeah, that statue, you know, that they removed.
You know,
well,
right. I mean, it's just,
yeah. Robert Lee was actually captured by the KGC for a period of time in Texas.
Really?
Yeah. Before it was right before he went to Washington to turn in his resignation.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and that for Robert E. Lee, it's like the Union wanted this slave, you know, enslaving person, this slave owner, to be the head of the Union Army.
Yeah.
But he chose Virginia.
Right.
You know, So anyway, we could go on endlessly, but I feel that Jefferson Stanford's story brings up all these kind of conflicts in my cerebellum.
Right. Yeah.
But well-written book, Jeff.
Thank you. Should we wrap it up with some more conspiracy talk really quick?
Sure.
Because that's my favorite aspect of the story, honestly. Like,
it's fun.
These questions, this mystery that's behind him.
Right.
So one of my theories on the 21st century Confederate Legion is that they're a modern-day remnant of the KGC because I'm the first person to put it in writing that Jefferson Stanford was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. Okay.
Right.
I had to pull together all these sources to figure this out, to put these pieces of this puzzle together. There was another guy who has a collection up at U of I who was an accountant who also came to the same conclusion back in the 60s, but he didn't publish any of this. Mm-hmm. You have to go through his collection to find his conclusion. He corresponded with Merle Wells about this. And so I have letters from Merle to I forget his name. But he talks about how Stanford was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle in those letters.
Merle Wells being preeminent historian of Idaho.
The state historian for a long time, yeah.
He passed away, 15, 20 years ago, was at Boise State.
So I'm waiting for access to his collection at the archives so I can find the other part of those letters. That'd be so cool.
When can that happen?
Last I talked to Angie, they were still indexing it, so I don't know.
Hurry up there. I know you're well-staffed and all.
Right, yeah. Come on. We love y'all. That was one of my theories, is that it's a remnant of the KGC and that they were able to identify Stanford as a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle, and that's why it's marked as how it is. Again, you really have to dig to even figure out that Jeff Stanford was this guy and who he was, and that he might have even been a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. So it's like, how did they know? I don't know how they knew. And that's one of the questions that digs at me, is why did they put this marker on his grave? How did they know, what he was doing? Did they do all the same research and things that I did to come to that conclusion? And the other interesting thing is that there's actually a folder missing from that collection.
Oh, yeah. I noticed that when you were writing about it. That's crazy.
And it's completely gone. And I'm led to believe from the, what do they call it? The index, it shows you the contents of that collection.
Yeah, the registry. No.
Anyway,
the index, yeah.
The index. I know there's a different name for it. But it shows, it talks about, it's basically about mining and probably more stuff about Stanford was in that folder. So
it drives you crazy.
It drives. I'm frustrated. This is years ago that I discovered this, and I'm still, frustrated about
it. It's sitting in some, I don't know, some old book, somebody tucked it away in an old book, and it's in some tome nobody has looked at in years in the library there.
I also tried to track down who made that stone. I talk about that in that last chapter, right?
Right.
I couldn't figure out. I contacted all the monument makers in Wyoming. So did they have it made wherever they lived and then ship it here or ship it to Wyoming?
Probably. It looks small.
I mean,
maybe they drove it up there from somewhere. I don't know.
It's pretty heavy.
Is it?
I don't know why I know that, but it is.
Well, you got to use a pry bar, Jeff. I've had plenty of experience with this.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, bodies ain't going to snatch themselves.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, wait, what are we talking about? The marker.
Yeah, so I don't know. I still have so many questions about his life and his death and what happened, so I think I'll ever get answers.
It's time for you to graduate to the Kennedy assassination. That's where you need to go next.
I already know. It was Woody Harrelson's dad.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard that?
No.
He was a suspect.
Oh, no way. Really?
Yeah, he was.
Woody?
All right. Should we wrap this one up?
We should wrap this one up.
All right. Well, if you've listened this long, thank you. You can grab a copy of my book, Brave as a Lion, Jeff Stanford and the Knights of the Golden Circle, published under the name J.D. Wade at Amazon. It's the only place you can get it right now.
If you want to learn a bunch of history that you haven't heard before, it's not just about Jeff Stanford. There's tons of going on here. You should pick it up. It's a good read. And he worked really hard on it.
I did. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for reading it. And thank you for indulging me.
I was scared I was going to read it and it was going to suck.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be like, I'm going to have to pretend that it was good. I really liked it. I read it quickly.
Oh, well, yeah, it's not too long.
No.
But yeah. Anyway, yeah, Amazon, I'll get like $3 if you buy a copy. So
yeah, but a whole big old pat on the ego.
Yes.
All right.
All right. We'll come back next week. We'll talk about Buffalo Soldiers in the Coeur d'Alene mining districts. And
correct.
Excited for that one because I know squat about that. So
just about how they were looked at during the mining wars when they had to act as sort of an authoritarian force against the miners up there, and versus how they were interpreted after the 1910 forest fire that happened up there.
Excellent. All right, we'll see y'all next week.
Sayonara.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Counting.